coming up.
Who'll pay reparations on my soul?
How would reparations help racial relations?
Anytime you say the word reparations, people think you're talking about people who are long dead. But in fact, there are people who are alive, who have been disadvantaged and injured by policies that were done in our name.
Should every person or institution who has benefited from our sorry history of racism be required to compensate the victims of racism?
The government doesn't owe Black Americans money because of slavery, because the government has already given Black Americans all sorts of things, including money, because of slavery.
Who'll pay reparations? 'Cause I don't dig segregation.
Guest is Michael Dawson, author of Not in Our Lifetime, The Future of Black Politics.
Who'll pay reparations on my soul?
Reparations, coming up on Philosophy Taught. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
And today, we're thinking about reparations.
Are Black people today owed reparations for the racial injustices of America's past?
Well, there certainly was a time in America's past for reparations, John. Back in 1865, after the Civil War, 40 acres and a mule for every former slave would have been a just outcome, I believe. Never happened, though.
Never happened is putting it mildly. Ken, instead of reparations and restorative justice, Black people were subjected to new forms of oppression. Sharecropping, Jim Crow segregation, separate but not quite equal schooling. Housing discrimination, and I haven't even mentioned lynching.
Yeah, John, yeah. But here's the thing. If Black people weren't paid reparations back after slavery, there's no way we're going to get them now. No way.
Well, don't be so sure. Germany paid reparations to the Jews. America paid reparations to the inter-Japanese.
But Germany paid the actual survivors of the Holocaust, not Jews in general. And the same thing with America and the Japanese.
Your point being?
Well, that reparations are easier for people to swallow when they can be paid to assignable victims who have been done assignable harms by assignable wrongdoers. That's not really our situation today, unfortunately.
So are you saying that there's no case for the justice of reparations?
Well, I'm not really saying that. I mean, I just think of my dad, for example. He was born the son of a dirt poor sharecropper in the darkest days of Jim Crow segregation. He confronted racism, virulent racism, at every turn in his life on a daily basis. So, yeah, maybe he would be owed reparations.
Yeah, and what about inner-city Blacks of the present who are consigned to failing schools, brutalized by cops? Vastly overrepresented in our prisons. Do you deny that that's based on racism?
Of course I don't deny that at all. But I think what people deserve are good schools, an end to police brutality, and more equitable criminal justice systems, not reparations.
Aren't those just part and parcel of the same thing?
Well, I don't know, John. I don't really see it that way. I mean, reparations are, I think they're mostly beside the point. Look, I'm all for social justice. I'm for improved education, health care for everybody, fair housing policy, a good social safety net, maybe even a guaranteed income. I want these things for all people, regardless of race. And I frankly don't really see how framing the issue in terms of reparations helps anything.
Well, it's at least a way of acknowledging society's special debt to Black people.
But then whose debt are we talking about exactly?
Well, white people's, of course.
Well, but try to convince today's white people of that. I bet many of them would dismiss the demand for reparations as special pleading arising from a culture of victimhood in search of handouts. Now, if that's how they're going to think about it, then you're framing things in terms of reparations. This doesn't actually resolve or reduce racial tensions. It just makes them worse.
Well, I think whites who think that are just wrong. A call for reparations isn't a call for handouts. It's a call for restorative justice, just like it was after the Civil War, when the wounds of slavery were still very fresh. our racial wounds are still not healed.
Look, I'm all for healing and I'm all for restorative justice. Those are powerful things. But, you know, they're kind of inherently backward-looking. We need forward-looking solutions, John, on to the future.
Can we ever get right with the future until we get right with the past?
Oh, what does getting right with the past even mean? What would that even mean in today's context? Look, no white person alive today was a slaveholder. No black person alive today was a slave. And even Jim Crow segregation, from which my father suffered, ended decades ago.
Well, until we take collective responsibility for the wrongs of the past, I don't think we'll ever heal. We'll be forever tainted by the racial sins of our forebears.
Well, whatever, but good luck trying to convince Americans, especially white Americans. Good luck trying to convince them of that.
Well, I didn't say it would be easy, Ken, but the conversation has to start somewhere.
You're right about that. So to help us get the conversation started, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shukin Kalantari, in search of some opposing views. She files this report.
During World War II, 60 million people were killed. That was about 3% of the world's population at the time. About 6 million of those deaths were Jewish people killed during the Holocaust. Jews had their land confiscated. Countries were left in ruin. In 1975, Germany paid Poland $1 billion in reparations and another $4 billion in 1995. Israel got the most, with about $90 billion in reparations, and the country is still getting money from Germany today.
I mean, I'm very sensitive to all of this stuff because, you know, I am of Jewish origin.
That's Richard Epstein. He's a law professor at New York University, a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, and a libertarian. He says though countries were given reparations, racism against Jews was palpable in the U.S. in the early 1900s.
And I can assure you that when my grandmother came to the United States and worked in the Triangle Waste Factory, there was a lot of vicious anti-Semitism going around here. I'm not asking for reparations. Damages for past wrongs, when they're done on a broad societal basis, are an incredible omelet, and you can never separate one ingredient from the other.
Epstein says it's impossible to gauge how he was personally affected economically by the Holocaust. And that, he says, is one problem with trying to give reparations to descendants of African slaves in the U.S.
If you're doing it for the first generation, essentially you know that the victims are the people who are receiving the compensation. If you're doing it for the sixth generation, you have no idea what fraction of any given person was somebody who was the descendant of somebody who'd been abused. In places like Barack Obama, they are half black because they come from Kenya, not a target for reparations. Half a mother from Kansas, not a target for reparations. The whole thing becomes a complete jumble.
Actually, Barack Obama is not in favor of reparations either. Here's an interview with him from 2008.
You know, I have said in the past, and I'll repeat again, that the best reparations we can provide are good schools in the inner city and jobs for people who are unemployed. Dealing with some of the legacy of discrimination is going to cost billions of dollars. And we're not going to be able to have that kind of resource allocation unless all Americans feel that they are invested in making this stuff happen.
Richard Epstein from the Hoover Institution says the U.S. has made efforts to right past wrongs, like starting an affirmative action program. But he doesn't think any government dollars should go to rectification towards African Americans or any other group. That, he says, should be left up to private institutions, like scholarship programs at universities.
This is a private university taking its own money, deciding that the buzzwords of diversity and inclusion really ought to, shall we say, influence and shape the policies that they adopt. And if they want to spend their hard-earned dollars on bringing in minority students, they should. There's a vast difference between doing it that way and doing it by public funds, and it's all in favor of the private solution.
Epstein wants to be clear. Racial segregation is bad. Slavery is evil. He says limiting people's ability to marry, find jobs, or buy property is absolutely indefensible. But he says the right path is to acknowledge our past wrongs, make a formal apology, and keep our eyes on the present.
To me, I don't care about reparations, frankly, but I do care about exclusion orders, particularly those issued at how do we say it, 4:43 in the afternoon on a Friday with no notice, which essentially disrupts the lives of thousands upon thousands of innocent people in order to keep people out of countries who have sent a grand total of 11 terrorists into the United States in the last 16 years. It's much more important to stop those kinds of things than it is to worry about these disputes of what happened in 1881.
Richard Epstein says if Americans focus on fighting current legislation that echoes the bigotry and racism from decades past, then maybe there won't be a need for reparations in our country's future. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for your roving philosophical report, and thanks to Richard Epstein for sharing his opinions with you. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're talking about reparations. We're joined now by Michael Dawson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, my PhD alma mater. He's a founding director of the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture, and author of Not in Our Lifetimes, The Future of Black Politics. Michael, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Michael, you're a political scientist, a great field full of interesting problems. You work on issues of race and politics. Was there some particular reason or event that got you interested in that question?
It's overdetermined. It runs in the family. My family was involved in Democratic Party politics in Chicago for half a century. One of my uncles was in Congress for 30 years. I had to go to Stanford to go find some place where people hadn't heard of the Dawson family so I could become a student activist. And as a student activist at the time in the late 60s, early 70s, reparations was part and parcel of the black movement. So as a student activist at Stanford, I started hearing about this strange concept called reparations.
So like a lot of African-American philosophers, you were influenced by the intensely radical environment at Stanford. He said, tongue-in-cheek. So what do
you
think?
You'd be surprised.
What's the right way to go? Reparations or, like Obama says, just investment in schools, especially inner-city schools, broader policies of social justice? Which way should we be going?
You're putting the cart before the horse. We should first have a conversation about restorative justice, what it would mean for this country to recognize its legacy of racial discrimination and racial oppression, the continuing legacy of that history, and what steps are needed. First, we have to have that discussion first before we decide universal programs or reparative justice or reparations.
But Michael, we've been at this for so long. We have such fraught racial relationships, such a fraught history. You know, it's a fraught history. Some people think, oh, reparations for slavery. But, you know, as John said in the opening, as we said in the opening, after slavery, there were more insults. We've had this for so long. A conversation? Aren't we past conversations?
How can we be past conversations when we still have active discrimination in labor, housing, loan, and consumer market? No, we're not past a conversation. We don't talk to each other about it. We talk about race in our homes, at dinner tables, in bars, with our friends, but we don't talk about it with our interracial friends.
Well, that's,
or if we do it.
That's true, but I mean, I grant you that. But I guess what the Obama thought is, we know what a just social order would be like, and we're not really anywhere near that. Well, yeah, equal opportunity, you know, access to all the basic goods of life.
But it is a philosophical.
You sound like a social democrat. Yeah. And last time I heard that wasn't very popular in this country. So you really think there's a consensus about what the good life looks like?
Well, I grant you that there's a contentious issue there. But I say we can agree about that without agreeing about how to settle the past. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
When you say a word like equal opportunity, though, it opens up lots, kind of a quagmire considerations. What constitutes equal opportunity? Is affirmative action enhance equal opportunity or detract from equal opportunity? At Berkeley, since California outlawed affirmative action, the main effect, as far as I can see, is that lots of Asian American students who were kind of underrepresented for their talents are streaming in, which is good, but it's probably questionable. So, get us started, Michael. Give us one thing we can all agree on about social justice.
There is no one thing we can all agree on social justice. What we can agree on is that we are radically split. So, for example, about 98% of white people oppose reparations. About 70 to 80% of black people support it. That's why we need to talk, because nothing's going to happen when we have so radically divided. It's not just on reparations. Anytime we talk about race in this country, the racial barriers go up and the racial divisions become exposed. That was the fatal flaw in Barack Obama, many in his racial program.
Okay, Michael, so we're going to have to take up the conversation after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about reparations.
Are black people today owed reparations as a result of what white people did to their ancestors?
Harms, debts, and reparations, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Inner city blues, inner city blacks. Does the whole thing make you want to holler for reparations? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about reparations.
Our guest is Michael Dawson. He's from the University of Chicago, and he's author of Not in Our Lifetimes, The Future of Black Politics.
So, Michael, that statistics you cited, you know, of the division between blacks and whites on this issue is really quite striking. And I think that one thing that underlies the white resistance to this is that the idea of reparations presupposes that we can hold people now responsible for things that their forebears did. And I think lots of white people might reject that thought. I mean, is that a justified thought, that we can hold this generation responsible for what previous generations did?
That's an understandable viewpoint, but I think it's one that's mistaken. What a restorative justice campaign or a reparations campaign, to be more blunt, would require is for us as a society to try to correct the wrongs of the past. So one of the two of you earlier said that white people would be held responsible. That's incorrect. I would be held responsible. I'm African American. My children, who are mixed race, Asian and African American, would be held responsible. We as American citizens will all be held responsible for the legacy of the past. I think that's a way that doesn't hold any particular group of people responsible, but it does hold us as society responsible, just as some institutions such as Georgetown University are being held responsible for the misdeeds they had with respect to slavery in the past and are now actively thinking about it as an institution about what type of restoration would be justified.
So I think it'd be helpful to have some more or less concrete proposals in front of us. Now, it seems to me that if we were convinced we wanted to give reparations, we have to decide what it was. So you say the first thing is the federal government establishes a huge fund. Then what do you do with it? Well, like you say, my mixed race grandchildren and children and yours don't automatically qualify for anything. If you let people apply, those with the best lawyers would get the most money, and that's not going to help. Maybe you could say school districts can apply for this money to help inner city schools. Does anything like that make sense and deserve to be called reparations?
Well, I think that's, if you look at the history of reparations in the United States, that's exactly the type of reparations that through most of the later part of the 20th century and people in the 21st century supported. Indeed, when we asked a national survey of Americans about what type of reparations, African Americans supported community trust, investment in schools, mm-hmm. building up community institutions. So there was not the cutting of a check for whom or whomever.
So look, I don't want to bring a note of disagreement to you guys who are having such
sure
a sympathetical discussion here, but it just seems to me now that you're getting to a reasonable place, but it's, I don't know that it's pointful to think of this in terms of reparations. Yes, we should have social justice. Yes, there's the Marxist principle, to each according to his need, from each according to his ability. Yeah, so you should have progressive taxation. Yes, you should target things in places of maximal need where the most injustice has happened. Why think of that in terms of reparations rather than just let's promote social justice? What does adding the frame of reparations add, especially if you take it away from assignable wrong done to assignable people by assignable perpetrators?
Let's back up 1 second, though, because one of the questions that we did ask on our survey was, should the identified victims, still living victims of Tulsa and Rosewood, which were two massive pogroms where hundreds of blacks were killed, and in the case of Rosewood, the city was destroyed, should they receive reparations? And there was still no support for that. So that's why I said we need a conversation. If we can't even agree about reparations for the identifiable victims of racist crimes, mass racist crimes, community crimes, where whole cities turned on their black communities, we have a basic problem we have to work out. Another example was that you mentioned in your opening Japanese American reparations for internment. When we did a survey experiment, when we asked a question about Japanese Americans first, it didn't affect people's support for reparations for African Americans. We asked a question for African Americans first, the support for Japanese American internment victims went down. There is something very basic about hostility toward reparations, restorative justice, acknowledging even support for apologies at very low levels in the white communities. Four out of five white Americans say that apology would not be justified for either Jim Crow or slavery.
You're listening.
So maybe we're thinking of reparations the wrong way, and if we think of the right way, we might want to ditch the word. But I don't think of it. It's too late to think of it, except in exceptional cases, as individuals owing reparations to individuals. It's our society owing something to itself. Our country in the past did things that damaged the present because of slavery. I can't agree with Mr. Epstein that the wrongs done to Jews are comparable, although I think the wrongs done to Native Americans are. So if we get that right, and then we don't worry about the word reparations, still, it seems to me that it shouldn't just be general social justice. It should be appreciation of the damage done to our country by racism. What do you think of that?
I think we should have to acknowledge two things. One is the damage done to our country by a system of racial oppression, and also the degree to which this country was built by not having to pay labor in the South, by continued discrimination in housing and loan markets, the ability of groups to become much more, to survive institutionally, as when slaves were sold by various universities. So I think we not only have to recognize the damage that was done, but the gains that were made as a result of these crimes.
Well, we ought to be honest. Our country was built on three pillars, a three-legged stool: Enlightenment ideals, land stolen from Native Americans, and slave labor.
Yeah, none of those they don't fit together so easily. We've got a caller, Jenny from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jenny.
Hi. I'm a religious Jew, and we were reading the Torah portion yesterday all about when Pharaoh finally let the slaves leave Egypt. And the last three plagues, like the eighth plague, Pharaoh said, or maybe it was the seventh, said, okay, I'll let the men leave, but not the women and children. And Moses said, no, it's got to be all of us. And then Pharaoh said, well, after the next plague, I'll let I'll just cut to the chase, which is that it said God told Moses, and Moses told the people, go to your neighbors before the last plague and ask for all their silver and gold and jewels, or, you know, whatever they'll give you. When I read this, I thought, wow, this is like complete biblical proof that reparations is due to former slaves, because, and descendants of former slaves, because the people, you know, God didn't want the people to leave until they had all their livestock and these extra precious gold and jewels from the Egyptians.
Okay.
Well, that's a good point, and certainly could be used in the argument, but I'm a little suspicious about this God, because it seems to me a couple of years later he told the Jews, you can kill everyone down there that has been living there for a long time, because you're not going to get them to leave, but it's okay to let the newcomers leave. So I don't find him a terribly reliable source for my moral standards.
Yeah, but I want to ask Michael, what do you think? Are there biblical justifications for reparations? I mean, are you moved by that biblical justification for reparations?
Not particularly. due to Stanford's Western Civ course, I'm a child of the Enlightenment, so I look for groundings for my justifications more in moral philosophy than for a religious basis.
So, okay, but then tell me more. So I'm still searching for speaking of the Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment, I'm kind of moved by Simone de Beauvoir, who says about the past, we should have an aesthetic attitude toward it. It's over. We can contemplate it as a thing of beauty or ugliness. We can judge those people. But those past disputes are not our disputes. And we should start from this moment and build justice forward. It sounds like you don't like that. You don't think that's impossible. Possible. Start from this moment. Ask, what does justice demand now going forward?
So I've taught de Beauvoir. She's a great philosopher, but I'm going to quote one from Harlem, who said, if you're running a race and somebody sticks a knife in your back and they pull the knife off and they say, now we can start fresh. How's that supposed to work?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's good. And, you know, like I say, if I'd been back in the 1860s, I would have been totally behind Lincoln on reparations. Still would have been by 1900, a lot of people. But now, I mean, we could look at it pragmatically. We look at the country. There's huge problems with inner cities and undereducated and unfairly treated blacks. Can we use the concept of reparations to help solve that problem? If so, we should. If not, we should move on somewhere else.
What do you think of that argument? It's a purely pragmatic cost-benefit thing. I think because John's, I think, thinking about the backlash it would cause among whites who are poor and blah, 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 and all that, and what about me, and, you know. So
Let me give you an analogy. So I'm supposed to take some kind of medication that will help me from getting senile, and I'm really reluctant to do it. But then I get a big injury on my arm that hurts, and it turns out the same medication will help that. So now we've got a reason to get me to take the medication. So think of reparations as a reason we can use to get something that's obviously necessary, that is more investment in inner city schools, affirmative action, things like that.
You think that's good or bad?
I think that it might be partly good. I think there's what we're forgetting is the symbolic element of reparations and restorative justice campaigns, and I think those are also important as well. I'm certainly a materialist who thinks that we have to figure out how those who are most disadvantaged are helped in this society, and I would certainly support that for all people who are disadvantaged. But there's also a symbolic question of one. How do we recognize the current continuing regime of not only racial divide, but racial disadvantage? Second, how do we talk about and recognize the legacy of the past crimes? And three, how do we acknowledge that as a political community?
Yeah, those are good questions. Sophia from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sophia. What's your comment or question?
Hi, I had a comment. I was listening to a program recently where someone tracked down their relatives. It was a descendant of slaves who tracked down their long-lost descendant of slave owner cousins. And the cousins were reluctant to speak with them. And I think the person realized that they were afraid that the person was coming to them saying, well, you owe me this. Because the same family still owned the land. And so it seems to me that people are still directly profiting from slavery. There are family fortunes that were built on it. It's not that long ago. And I think restorative justice is important. I really think investing in communities is important, but there's direct money owed in terms of inheritance that I think can be given to individuals. And if you follow this idea to its conclusion, I mean, obviously people who are descendants of mill workers are owed by the descendants of the factory owners, but these cases are so obvious and so glaring, and the unfairness is just so complete that it seems to me there's a lot to be gained by direct reparations.
Thanks, Sophia. What do you think, Michael?
I think there's certainly cases like that. For one, for example, Georgetown has decided that the descendants of the slaves that they sold earlier in their history were identified and then offered scholarships and other benefits. So I think there's certainly similar claims have been presented to insurance companies and other universities. I think there's certainly a role for that, and I'm not ruling those out. I think that the larger problems of black communities as part of restorative justice campaign would have to talk about investment in those communities, including investments in individuals.
Right, right. So a really quick question. Okay, you think it would be easier to have a campaign of social justice if we framed it in terms of reparations, or harder? That's what I'm not sure. It would be...
Oh, I think it would be harder. I don't think there's any question about that. But it's also a question of what's right and wrong. And can we actually move forward as a political community without acknowledging the racial divisions that exist among us and the racial crimes that are collectively responsible in the past?
Okay. Well, so we'll have to take this up and how we do this in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about reparations with Michael Dawson from the University of Chicago.
Even if there is a good philosophical argument for reparations, an abstract argument, is there any established politician, at least anyone with national ambitions, who would risk their career to advocate for reparations?
The political will, or lack thereof, for reparations, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Australians found political will to pay reparations to the Aborigines. What would it take in America? Not for us to pay reparations to Australians, but to descendants of American slaves. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Michael Dawson from the University of Chicago, and we're thinking about reparations.
Michael, wouldn't a national politician, somebody who wanted to get far in politics, just be committing political suicide by even hinting at reparations being a good thing?
Yes, we saw that play out already in 2016 and during the Democratic primaries when the debate began to percolate around reparations, partly due to Coates' Atlantic Magazine article, and Sanders came out immediately saying reparations were not a useful debate. Democratic Party politicians at the national level have condemned reparations as at best not useful, as a best not useful discussion for decades now. And it's not just reparations. Talking about race has been something that both parties has shunned until relatively recently, partly due to the experience of Bill Bradley and Jack Kemp, who are trying to talk across party lines about how the racial divide in this country and how to move forward, and neither of them, their career progressed much afterwards.
Yeah, so the lesson I take from that, from the politicians, I don't regard politicians as irrational people, right? They're kind of pragmatic. They may be unprincipled people. They're kind of they put pragmatism often above principle, even when they endorse the principle in their heart of hearts, right? Because they have to get things done. Politics is the art of the possible, right? You say we need to have a conversation. Americans aren't any good at talking to each other about race. They just aren't. They never have been. You know, some politicians are good, like Bill Clinton was good, at suggesting remedies that address people kind of regardless of race. Sometimes they're half rear end because they won't take into account explicit race. But isn't that just the reality? Americans don't talk to each other about race. Politicians know that.
So are we just spinning our wheel? Are we just spinning our wheels here, or what?
I'm going to sound like a philosopher for a second. I'm going to, in my last book, I talked about a concept called pragmatic utopianism. And what I meant by that was, and I wasn't making an argument for reparations when I was making this argument, was that we need to be very utopian and take what we think is possible off the table. That's been the heart and soul of black politics for the last 200 years. Oh, we can't get rid of the civil rights movement. You want too much too fast. Or we can't end lynching. It's supported by the masses of citizens and blah, blah, blah. Anything we want on race is going to look to be suicidal to at least a regional or national political party leader, and it will seem to be undoable and unwelcome by many Americans. So we have to think about what we want, and then the pragmatic part is doing the type of things that the civil rights movement did, which is, does it take massive civil disobedience? Does it take a massive propaganda campaign? Does it mean allowing parents to allow their children to place themselves at risk in places like Birmingham in marches where they're confronting really violent police forces? So the pragmatic part is that getting from A to B, but we have to start about where we want to end up first. You know, and that's where the conversation begins.
I find that very moving. I find that very moving. It actually appeals to some deep part of me, the part that's a philosopher and that believes in the ideal and not just the real and all that. So part of me is very moved by what you said, deeply. Another part of me is like, but politics really is the art of the possible in the here and now, and what's possible is highly path dependent and highly contingent. And I mean, how do you reconcile these two things?
But it is contingent, though. But it is contingent. So if we had said if you had told asked somebody in 1953, that in 10 years most of the architecture for state-sponsored Jim Crow would be dismantled, that would have sounded like you were smoking something that Stanford students in 1968 smoked quite commonly.
What did you smoke in 68?
Okay, let's
Kohl's, a menthol cigarette that really was very bad for me.
But, okay, sorry. That would have sounded
But the point is that things that we have been deemed impossible when it comes to race. In 1945, you asked General Patton, are we going to desegregate the military? Of course not. Hmm. 3 years later, it's done.
So I believe in visionary reframing. I think the civil rights movement worked in part because Martin Luther King and his companions were brilliant tacticians and strategists, and they knew something, they believed something that was true about the American consciousness. If you showed them close up and didn't let them hide from the reality of segregation and the brutality of it, if you didn't let it hide behind closed doors but brought it out in the open, brought the television cameras, it would shock the conscience of many Americans enough to, right, enough to move politicians. Even to make politicians take risks. Okay, so there are moments when we can do things like that. I don't see how we can get the same kind of shared shocking of the consciousness behind reparations. Because it has a feel of blaming and this and dividing. And
so, first of all, that's not the story they tell about the movement themselves. If you read King's Where Do We Go From Here?, he says the success of the movement was not due to the changing hearts and minds. It was due to forging political power, and he's quite explicit about that. And that what he said we needed more of at the time was, and this is a not very often quoted because it doesn't fit our conception of King, was more black power, both economic, political, and social. So what the counter-narrative to yours is that it wasn't changing hearts and minds. It was producing in the international arena and domestically enough political conflict to force politicians to do the right thing.
You think it was heightening contradictions kind of thing?
It was heightening, to use a phrase that I think I heard somewhere before, yes. And it had, if you look at public opinion polls, it tends to support that. There was never a majority for the support for the actual programs that came out of the civil rights and later black power movement. There's certainly revulsion of dogs attacking children on the street on the evening news. No question about that. But that wasn't it wasn't the moral consciousness or the moral conscience of the nation being awakened that was decisive, according to civil rights leaders and historians.
Well, we've got email from Cindy in Cincinnati that might strike you as a bit odd. But she says, look, how about a typical American pragmatic solution? A special tax break for individuals who claim that they have benefited from slavery and contribute to programs that benefit social justice and, in particular, the effects of racial injustice. Cynical, but maybe effective. What do you think?
I think if we're talking about that on an institutional basis, like corporations, universities, and other longstanding institutions that benefit from either slavery or Jim Crow, that's being done. It's been relatively effective. The movement around that is growing, and I think it's a good idea. I don't like the idea of targeting families, however. I think that's where we go, come back to that. Slavery and Jim Crow were the result of state policies, a community that as a nation we need to repudiate and then to figure out what the best way to move forward. Now, one of the things I think we've been sloppy about is conflating restorative justice campaign with reparations. A restorative justice campaign may come to the conclusion that universal programs are the best way to go to improve a lot of those who are dealing with the legacy of past systems of discrimination and racism. But it also might come to the conclusion that reparations is the way to go. So yeah. I think we're conflating that too much.
Right. So let me, in preparing for this, I read some about the history of reparations movements around the world. And I was surprised to learn that many Jews, when the issue of German reparations came up, were opposed because they did not want to launder Hitler's money. They wanted nothing to do with the Germans' money. Is there any kind of attitude like that among the movement for black reparations?
There's some. I think it's a minority view, but I certainly have heard those types of sentiments expressed within black discourse on reparations.
Do you give that any kind of credence? I mean, I was surprised by that. But then as I read this, I thought, well, I kind of see what they were getting at. Do you give that any kind of – you think there's any force to that kind of consideration?
I think there's a force, particularly among those who have a more nationalist orientation, who have also said we should reject aid from the government, we should reject foundation money, and that we need to really rely on a particular form, in their view, of self-help and self-reliance to move forward as a people.
Yeah, but you... that's not your view. I mean, you wouldn't care.
That's not my view.
Because that's a kind of a militant separatist thing. That's how it sounded when I was reading this stuff about we're going to build our own society. We don't need their money.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a type of nationalism which I've actually, in my other hat many years ago as a political activist, actively struggled against.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to make you czar of the world for the
last...
You
really don't want to do that.
But you only get for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
You get 2 minutes as czar of the world.
And you can't tweet...
Yeah, what are you going to do? How are you going to...
Do I have launch codes?
Yeah. You have plenary powers to change the world. What do you do? Briefly.
I would very quickly go, if I only have 2 minutes, toward some universal programs like universal health care. I would certainly expand guaranteed minimum income to all the type of programs that a Republican administration in the early 70s was willing to support. although now they seem quite radical, radical left
right.
fringe
return,
programs.
Return to Nixon's policies. They weren't
Moynihan.
So bad.
Well, Moynihan wrote them, right? I mean, yeah. The domestic side of it. on an expanded scale, I would also think that we have to look at the type of harms. We would have to study the type of harms. That's why 2 minutes is not enough. That have been done to particularly communities and the legacies, and figure out what the best way. In addition to, is there anything beyond the universal program that needs to address those wrongs?
Yeah. So okay.
Certainly symbolically there is.
Yes.
There has to be acknowledgement, but also possibly materially.
I vote for you for czar.
Okay. So Michael, we're going to have to thank you for joining. This has been a very interesting restorative reparative conversation, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Michael Dawson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He's author of Not in Our Lifetime, The Future of Black Politics. So, John, you got a really quick thought?
It's a messy topic, and I'm not sure what to say even after our good discussion.
Yeah, it is a messy topic. I think I'm in favor of all kinds of things that the reparations people would recommend. I'm just not sure I would argue for them in terms of reparations. But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, get this, is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community. All you have to do is visit our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, here's someone who talks so fast he can talk himself right back into the past and change things. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Ta-Nehisi Coates, our go-to literary guy for all things racially fraught here in the sparse 21st century, had an essay in Atlantic Magazine back in 2014, The Case for Reparations, pondering whether reparations to black people might be in order. He thought yes. Of course, this being Atlantic Magazine, any controversial article bears the unmistakable taint of clickbait. But then any opinion these days really is automatically tainted unless it's sanctioned by Steve Bannon or his creepy alt-right acolytes. And any discussion of reparations brings up the usual arguments from that crowd, one of them, black people own slaves too. Therefore, ipso facto, white people are blameless, and somewhat always becomes about how unfair everything is to white men. After slavery was abolished, it was replaced with segregation because, the logic went, if we all live together, we become morbidly race conscious. See, black people aren't free labor anymore, which makes white men look and feel bad. And when white men feel bad, it leads to trouble. And it leads to Donald Trump logic. We're in charge, therefore not only are we right, we can do no wrong and never did. So shut up. So there's that. Others point to the hopelessness of reparations. How can we even find the offspring of slave owners to charge them? Do they even have money, or just a tattered Confederate flag, sun bleached from covering a hole in the window of the dead pickup? Doesn't seem fair that white folks whose relatives hadn't even got here yet should pay for sins they did not commit. What about black people recently arrived from Haiti, Africa, or Cuba? Do they get a piece of that reparation pie? To my mind, this issue is kind of like insurance. We don't all use it, but we all have to kick in, otherwise it doesn't work. Or retirement funds. We all pitch in. Conservatives hate that stuff, unless they get a piece of it. Investors love retirement and insurance monies. It's a huge chunk of change they can take to the casino. I mean Wall Street. And if they lose it, well, it's because black people have poor money management skills. I think that's how it works. Anyway, Ta-Nehisi Coates' notion is to forget about slavery and all that stuff and just concentrate on repaying people for the 20th century. And there's plenty there. In 1929, just for one example, the prosperous black community of Greenwood in Oklahoma was burned to the ground and close to 300 people killed. Those survivors' relatives are maybe entitled to something. Maybe just give them Tulsa. Don't you think that's fair? Well, sure, but forget about it. Giving out money or property would just feed lawyers, really, if we're going to be honest about it. In lieu of reparations, I suggest making it mandatory for white people to be enslaved by black people for a year or so, kind of like the draft. Not even a year, a month, a week. You have to live with a black person for a week and do whatever that black person says you have to do. If you refuse, he gets to shoot you. Not kill you, that'd be creepy, but a shotgun blast in the rump, a little rock salt, make you limp for a bit, then you're back to normal looking for a job as an Uber driver in the sharing economy. That might work. Of course, conservatives are claiming that racism is dead because Obama got elected. Well, now he's gone, and racism has come roaring back, even to the extent that the white folks in charge are bent on removing any trace that indicates Obama ever even been there. But as far as reparations go, as long as there are vouchers involved, I predict conservatives might back it. Vouchers make a conservative's heart go pit-a-pat. It's privatizing, which is always good, because their buddies get a piece of it. A thing used to be free with your tax dollars. Now we charge for it, but issue a voucher so you get it at a discount. Aren't you proud to be an American? You are? Well, that'll be $10, half off 20. No, wait, we'll make Mexico pay for it. Yeah, I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Okay.
20th century crimes.
So we'll just do lynching?
housing segregation, employment segregation, Social Security, GI Bill, Medicaid.
Stealing, jazz, rock and roll, and rap.
Vanilla Ice.
Exactly.